Hey everyone, and welcome to this Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. This isn't our weekly news and current affairs show. This is a wholly sponsored podcast series we do here at Risky Biz about 14 times a year. And the idea is vendors pay to come onto the show and talk about the things that they want to talk about. And today's Soapbox is brought to you by Signal Sciences. If you're not familiar with them, they make web security software. If you operate a web property and you're looking to auto-block a lot of the common attacks and common attack techniques that are likely to be directed against your website, then Signal Sciences are definitely worth a look. Their whole pitch is really about making software that's easy to deploy. You just drop it on your web server or run it as like a WAF, as like a proxy, and bang, you know, you're done. Most of their clients run this software in full blocking mode out of the box, and they don't have any issues. It's also very good at blocking stuff like CRED stuffing and weird bot activity, as well as your sort of typical OWASP-y style attacks. Signal Sciences' trusted AppSec advisor, Philip Maddox, is our guest today. And yeah, we spoke about a bunch of stuff, really. As you'll hear, we started talking about the future of AppSec, how the pivot to serverless will change things and is changing things. Then we talked about app layer deception. You know, is that a thing you'll want to do? Anyway, here is Philip Maddox of Signal Sciences talking about AppSec, deception, RASP, and some other stuff too.
When I think about the future of InfoSec and AppSec itself, it definitely, things are moving to the app layer, right? So you think about the cloud platforms that are out there, namely PaaS, and of course you have serverless, right? So networks are kind of, you know, fading away. You think about Google's Beyond Corp, and you know, even at Google now, you know, employees can access their resources from any location, any device. So kind of the traditional border firewalls going away. There's a lot of talk about zero trust and all that these days. But everything is kind of, I see in the future, the far off future, really the only thing an organization is exposing to the world or to the internet is port 443, right? Mm. Everything becomes an app. Everything's pushing up to that. So AppSec is becoming more and more important because of that. And, you know, I mentioned the cloud platforms. You think about PaaS and how those, even just the deployment to those platforms works, right? So a developer writes some code and they run a quick push command and it's pushed out and automatically deployed to some cloud environment, right? There's no infrastructure to manage or maintain. And in some cases, you're relying on the cloud provider to handle, you know, a good portion of the security that normally your, you know, infrastructure teams would be worried about. So yeah, I think just with the trend of the shift to the cloud and you know, the adoption of these, you know, serverless type platforms, AppSec is definitely becoming more and more critical.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the networks that are fading in terms of importance. It really is this, you know, I think the push to serverless, it's the conversation around serverless now feels like the conversation around cloud 10 years ago. You know what I mean? Like it's just, it's got that vibe to it where there's a bit of talk about it, but before you know it, it's going to be absolutely everywhere real quick. Because why would you maintain your whole stack when you don't have to?
Right, exactly. In fact, I know a local company, I'm here in Raleigh, North Carolina, and they're just, you know, explicitly, you know, it's a decision to not manage any infrastructure, right? The only thing they do infrastructure as code, and obviously their applications as code, and they're choosing not to manage any of that. So it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, obviously there's a reduction in cost potentially with staff, right? Like you're saving, you don't have to hire that infrastructure engineer or what have you. You're just relying on your cloud provider to provide all that, those services for you.
Where does that leave a company like Signal Sciences though? I'm curious because, you know, the way that you work is you're either sort of sitting in line in front of an application or you're running on the web server itself. Like, how do you deploy to serverless?
Yeah, absolutely. So that gets interesting, especially, you know, I kind of get to it as I think further down the road in the future of where things are going. But I think, you know, Signal Sciences has different ways to deploy. It could be deployed as a part of the application itself. But it can also be deployed, you know, as a part of infrastructure, but as a part of your cloud infrastructure. So you can deploy it up into the cloud along with your applications. And just one example is, you know, it could be like a reverse proxy type scenario in front of your application, but as a part of that cloud deployment. So it kind of bakes into your application deployments and just, you know, gets pushed out with it. Whether you're deploying to these, you know, whether it's, you know, Kubernetes or some of the PaaS platforms out there and things like that. And so so that's how Signal Sciences, you know, addresses those types of applications.
Mm. I'm curious what you think is going to be the uptake there and how quickly that might be upon us.
I think it's happening pretty quickly. I mean, I think every conversation, you know, I've been in with a lot of our prospects and customers, they're talking about serverless, they're thinking about serverless in whatever form that is, whether it's, you know, platform as a service or functions as a service and things like that. So we're definitely seeing from experience and talking with customers out there and even prospects, right, that people are thinking about it. And they actually have allocated projects to migrate certain applications to these platforms. So I think it's going to ramp up. It's been increasing in velocity this past year, but I think it's going to just get more and more as we go forward in the next couple of years.
Where does that leave things like Kubernetes though? Like, because I'd imagine once you move to a serverless, you know, to a serverless service, you've got, you know, all of that stuff's happening in the background and being managed by your cloud provider, so you don't even need to deal with it, right? So I can imagine that for some people, it's like a confusing time right now because they're not sure where they should best skill up.
Yeah, exactly. I think if you eventually Kubernetes gets kind of abstracted away, right? So you go back to that model of just pushing code and it automatically gets deployed. Of course, you've got, you know, larger kind of institutions or organizations that are a little bit more cautious of moving to that model, or they have regulatory requirements. So they're going to want to manage, you know, for a period of time, their own, you know, Kubernetes environments and things like that. But I think eventually down the road, right, even with, you know, heavily regulated organizations, the risks that they're concerned about and they're trying to mitigate by kind of controlling their own environments and not fully giving it up to the cloud, I think eventually the cost savings starts to outweigh the risks. So those conversations.
Well, that's exactly what happened with cloud generally, right? Because the original conversation was like, no, we can't let our data, you know, touch metal on another computer outside of our data center. That's incredibly risky. And now, you know, no one says that. I mean, there are certain requirements for like government systems and whatever that the cloud data centers themselves need to, you know, have certain physical security characteristics, whatever. But like that is not what, you know, CIOs now don't worry about hosting stuff with Amazon,
right? Because the cloud providers have responded, right? They now understand that, hey, we've got to meet these you know, requirements for our customers in order for them to adopt our services, right? So you know, again, thinking down further in the future, right, and you've probably heard this before, is that the cloud providers are going to be able to eventually, well, they are today in some sense, but eventually they'll provide better security for organizations than the organizations can provide for themselves, right?
Yeah.
Because you have that talent problem, like trying to find talented folks that can help secure the environments the proper way. And also how do you scale, you know, limited talent? You can't really do that. So, you know, I've had this lightning talk where I do put forward that, like, hey, everything's going to be provided by the cloud providers. They're going to fully take care of all the security, you know, from obviously they've got to care for their own infrastructure and protect that. But even at the app layer, right, like they might even start providing application layer type protections, especially when it comes to, you know, things like distributed denial of service and things like that. And they'll have to, because organizations, if they're not thinking about this, they need to start thinking about a multi-cloud, you know, solution, right? You know, there's been, you know, various instances of outages and things like that. So a good question to ask, you know, organization to ask itself is, you know, if we have a cloud outage for an hour, how much money do we lose, right? And that the answer to that question may drive them to have a multi-cloud strategy, right?
Well, so, that's a whole other topic about the resilience of the internet economy generally. And I think Dan Gear had some thoughts on that. And his thoughts seem to be, well, if one of the major cloud platforms dropped and everyone tried to migrate to the other ones, like the whole internet would basically fall over. So that's a fun chat, but that's another conversation. So it feels like, you know, things like BeyondCorp, you know, they're good. People are sort of chipping away at them bit by bit, right? Going to get there. That's sort of a long-term arc. That's a long-term trend in sort of, you know, enterprise computing. Whereas it feels like serverless has that feeling of something that might be approaching some sort of tipping point. People are doing it already. They're realizing some cost savings. They're transitioning some apps there already. So the question becomes, like, what does this do for application security as a discipline? I mean, I'm guessing that, you know, just code quality all of a sudden becomes very, very important. So that puts the code quality businesses in a pretty good spot. But I'd also imagine that, you know, it's not so bad for you because you're really in the visibility business. Well, I guess, and the auto blocking business, but you're in the, you know, God, I'm going to gag saying it, the next generation WAF business. That's you guys.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So definitely there's the code quality aspect of it, but certainly there's that visibility piece. And it's, you know, you think about kind of application performance monitoring done today. That has to be done for security as well. And that's what Signal Sciences provides, right? So having that visibility in you know, production in your applications, understanding what types of, you know, weird requests are hitting it and attacks and things like that, gives you that feedback loop so you can understand how to better, you know, defend your applications either in real time, or that's feedback that goes back to the application developers to inform them on how their application is being attacked so they can ensure that the code is trued up to be able to defend against that. So it's vastly important to have that visibility. And, you know, I also, again, I kind of go back to like this way off in the future. You know, I think, you know, really security is going to just be, you know, dashboards monitoring, you know, basically the behavior of the application through this visibility, and then looking for deviations from what's normal, and then diving in to be able to see what's going on there. Is it a code bug that got released, or is someone actually trying to like fuzz our application or, you know, tamper with things? So,
well, this is why you've got this catch cry that really cuts against the grain, which is you want to shift right, not left, which is, you know, the opposite of what everybody says. This seems to be your guiding philosophy.
Exactly. For me, in my experience, you know, I hear shift left today, and I understand it. It's important. You do need to go, you know, test early on in the life cycle. But for me, in my career, I feel like we've been doing that for years, right? And we're still, you know, seeing SQL injection, you know, happen, and cross-site scripting and those common kind of attacks occur. And so, yes, this shift right, I think it's time for security, especially AppSec, to start thinking about shift right. And, you know, one of our co-founders, Zane, you know, calls it basically attack-driven defense, right? Like seeing how your applications are being attacked, which drives, you know, your defense strategy, right? And that's I think
we should probably tell the listeners right now that is actually how people are using Signal Sciences, right? Is like once they're running it, you know, first of all, it's going to mop up a lot of the dumb stuff, right? So that frees you up to not have to create rules for absolutely everything because it's got some pretty good default rules. But you can really see where you're having trouble. You can see where the funny stuff is going on. And then that gives you a chance to actually respond to it because the visibility aspects are pretty clear when it comes to something like Sig Sciences.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of funny. I get a kick out of every time, you know, a new customer onboards, they deploy into production. And after a short period of time, they're looking at the data and all of a sudden they're like, wait a minute, we never realized our application was being used in this way or hit in this way. Right. So the light bulb and the lights kind of turn on, right? So you can actually see what's going on. You have a better sense of, you know, what you should be focused on. It helps with prioritization. But I'm working with our customers every day, and there's always new scenarios coming up that I'm helping them leverage Signal Sciences to start addressing. And it is, you know, it's interesting because it's a lot less the, you know, typical OWASP injection attacks, right? Because we have technology in our solution that really takes care of that pretty cleanly out of the box without any tuning required or anything like that. And it really, the focus begins to be on what's more important which is like the misuse and abuse of the applications that are going on. And so that's what I typically end up, working with our customers and focused on with them and helping them mitigate those
threats. Give us some examples there, right? Because, we can talk about application abuse as a, generic concept or application misuse, but what's a good example of that that'll make people go, click, I get it now?
Yeah, I think a real easy example that I think a lot of people, it'll resonate with them, and this is the big one, right, is account takeover type scenarios, right? Credential stuffing attacks and things like that. What I find interesting is I'm seeing our customers face that, weekly or day to day, more often than the injection type of attacks, right? But there's other scenarios like abuse of credit card validation functionality, of course, scrapers. So it does deal with a lot of automation and bots and things that are out there. One interesting kind of use case that I like to apply where it's possible, depending, and a lot depends on the application, right? Because every application is unique, is applying the concept of known good, right? You know what valid requests should look like coming into your application. And this works especially well for like if you have mobile apps, right? You have a mobile app that's calling an API or some other type of device like a, Roku or Apple TV or something to that effect.
That's going to be real predictable. I mean, everything about that scenario is going to be predictable.
Exactly. So you not only do you know what those requests look like, so you can we can basically define in Signal Sciences, if any request contains an attribute or value that falls out of bounds of what known good is, then that's something we want to look at, right? Like that's suspicious, potentially malicious. And so that has worked, extremely well with our customers. And that turns up all kinds of various scenarios. And the interesting thing about that is I kind of call it being agile in production, right? Because if you think about it, you control the client code, right? And it can even work in, your web browser application-based applications as well. But you control the code, which means you can keep moving, right? So if the attacker, tries to figure out what did you do to block them, they start doing some reverse engineering on your app to determine that. Well, you have the ability to keep moving and keep changing that, right? So you can change what known good looks like. So you become a moving target, which I think is a huge capability, right? Like you really haven't had that capability before. And so to be able to maintain being a moving target starts to give the dev teams and the application security folks the advantage over the types of attacks that they're experiencing.
Well, one of the things that we actually had on the list to speak about today is this idea of putting some sort of deception capability into applications, which I mean, they can be good for some types of alerting. I imagine in that scenario where you've got pretty clearly defined requests coming in from code that you control, if you start putting just some areas in there, some fields that never get used, for example, when they start getting used, you've got problems. But I guess no one's ever quite found this application-based deception approach to be useful enough to really go for, Like, but I'm just wondering, yeah, is that changing?
I think it is. I'm definitely seeing folks look at organizations, think about deception more, and are wanting to kind of dip their toes in the water, so to speak, in that. And I think today when you think about deception, it's kind of more network-based focus and things like that. But I think as we go forward and we move to the future of this kind of app layer world, right, deception has to move up that stack and become a part of the app layer. And so, especially as you pointed out, right, like for applications that are not well-defined, like mobile apps or what have you, it becomes even more important. Being able to use, deception to identify those sources or users that, cause themselves to be exposed as not a legitimate user because they're doing something funny with the application, right? It's going to be interesting because every application is different. There's going to be some common things you can apply, with deception to all applications or many applications, but with the uniqueness of each application, there does need to be a tailored approach, right? So
that begs the question, why do you bother, right? Like, like a lot of work is what I'm getting.
I think that's a maturity piece. But one thing I see where AppSec teams can get to that point, and I'll kind of go back to the value of Signal Sciences, right? With Signal Sciences, it's a web protection solution that you don't have to babysit, right? And I'm comparing that to legacy type WAF solutions where you have to tune rules and constantly work with the app teams to make sure things are not going to break. So you're now freed up from having to do that. So you can focus on more important things, which are the misuse and abuse that your applications are facing. So I think in time, as you know, especially our customers using Signal Sciences, as they start to become, you know, better Signal Sciences pros and really taking advantage of the capability that they have at their hands, they're going to start looking at, okay, what's the next layer that we can add to this, right?
And I think, so yeah, I mean, look, any good tool is going to free you up to do the higher value work, right? Like that's the whole point of it, right? Is like, okay, I don't have to continuously babysit this WAF that could break things in production, and you know, just really, really watch it like a hawk, and very carefully understand what's going on with it. So you know, once you're not doing that, if it's more of a set and forget type of scenario, then you can start using the telemetry, dive in, look for signs of abuse, look for signs of you know, funny error message, all sorts of stuff. You know, start diving into that telemetry. Right, that makes a lot of sense. I guess the question becomes, though, is introducing some sort of deception capability into an application actually a good use of that new time that you all of a sudden have?
I think so. I think it is. And it kind of goes back to the, you know, if you think about just a plain, you know, network honeypot, right? Like you might deploy that and, you know, you might not think there's any value there because it's been deployed for 2 years and, you know, you haven't gotten an alert from it, right?
Yeah, so, but the day that it goes off.
Exactly. The day it goes off, that's going to be the day you want 100 more honeypots.
Yeah, well, that has actually been Haroon's experience with Thinxt is a company will buy like a few and they roll them out. And then, you know, like a year later, they order 200. You know?
Right. Exactly. So I think we'll see that same kind of trend occur within application deception, you know, especially with a solution that like Signal Sciences that really, you know, the capability it provides with its rules platform, an advanced rules platform, I like to say it gives you the ability to instrument your applications for security without having to actually instrument your application. And by that, I mean at the code level, right? Like, you don't have to get developers to integrate certain things, you know, code to, you know, give off certain signals when events happen, right? So having that capability to instrument your applications starts to give you that ability to, you know, even go down that path of, you know, implementing deception techniques in your defenses.
So, I mean, a deception technique, I mean, it always involves a lure, right? Something that looks tempting that someone's going to just, you know, poke. Basically, and that sets off the alarm because legitimate use should never touch that thing. So what does that look like from an application standpoint? What are you actually doing in terms of a lure?
Yeah, you can start with very basic stuff. And this is very simple. Like anybody could do this today and just kind of, you know, from logs and especially, you know, coupled with signals that you can generate with Signal Sciences. Just, you know, add some, you know, denies to your robots.txt, right? Some paths and folders that, you know, you kind of deny to robots, right? And maybe it's called, you know, /admin or something like that, right? That obviously in the application itself,
you're going to get a lot of hits on that, man. You know, like,
but you know, bots that are honoring the robot.txt won't hit it, but other things will, right? So that gives you information about things that are not really following the rules of the game. You could put things in comments, right? HTML comments, right? Like a developer's note, right? With some path and password or credentials or something silly like that. That could be useful. One thing, another kind of interesting approach,
See, I like that second one better than the first one because under that first scenario, you're going to get just so many that you're going to block half the ISPs on the planet. You know what I mean? You're going to block their proxies, right? Because it's just too generic. But I like that second one. That's good.
Potentially. You don't necessarily have to block. Like that information could feed into like some kind of anomaly detection engine or something like that.
Yeah, it's like
right?
If we see that from here plus something else, then you know.
Yeah. Exactly. Another thing, I actually run a project called HoneyDB, and I recently, and it's basically, I call it like community-driven honeypot sensor data aggregation. But there's a honeypot sensor you can deploy, and then it collects things into a central place. But one of the things I put together, just thinking about this idea with applications and honeypots or deception, is basically deploying, you know, kind of a web-based honey solution out to, you know, wherever, like on Heroku or some, you know, cloud platform. And then point like DNS to it, right? Like off of like, if, you know, if you're, you know, company.com, you know, why don't you create a subdomain, you know, blog.company.com or admin.company.com.
Or if you want it to be really tempting, wordpress.company.com.
Right. There you go. Exactly. Exactly. And then point that to the honeypot solution, right? And see, because I often think about, and this is something that I know that's come up on one of your shows a really long time ago when you talked about bug bounties. I think the question was, you know, what does a bug bounty, you know, a person go after, right? Like, where do they have the most success? And the answer was, typically the best success is in the non-production systems, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I'm talking to actually one of your customers at the moment on behalf of AssetNote, very large company with some, you know, with a handful of really critical assets. And they don't want us to do anything active against those main production assets because they earn a lot of money from those main production assets, right? So they're a little bit worried. They've got some older stuff on there and they're like, no, you can't scan them. And I'm like, this is not going to rob any of the value from like on the asset note side of things, because it's not finding bugs in your main production assets. That's not what we do. We find all the other ones that you don't even know you had, you know, like on assets you didn't know you had. So those dangling right. domains. And so I totally get it, because if you look at the way people are doing modern recon, you know, you put something in a zone file, people are going to find it, right? They're going to go after that.
Exactly. So imagine if one of those subdomains is staging.company.com or dev.company.com, right? And so there you could start to get, you could start to see, you know, some interesting, you know, traffic coming in. And obviously you'd want to, you know, create that environment to look similar to what your, you know, dev or stage environment might look like. But obviously, you know, that is not a, you know, legitimate domain that your developers or your team should be using. So anybody hitting it is, you know, becomes a part of that, you know, kind of anomaly detection.
But I guess what do you do with that information? Do you then just give the originating IP like a +2 shady points? I mean, because you can't, it's not strong enough to block on, right? So what is it strong enough to do?
Yeah, it's going to totally depend on the organization and who their expected users are. We actually have a customer that does, he's pretty straightforward, right? He has a honeypot sensor out there, and he pulls the data from the honeypot, basically the IPs from the honeypot. And then he uploads those IPs via the Signal Sciences API to a blacklist in Signal Sciences. Right. So that it immediately cuts off any IPs that were hitting that honeypot, because he's confident that really no legitimate customer user should ever even see this or know how to get to it. Right.
See, I just worry about things like corporate NAT gateways and ISP, you know, like transparent proxies, which, you know, you block a major ISP's transparent proxy, you're going to be blocking a lot of legitimate use as well. That's why I'm like,
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the key, you know, aspects to Signal Sciences and its blocking and how it implements blocking, right? It's not going to, once it reaches a decision to block against malicious traffic, it's not going to block all traffic coming from that IP. It's only blocking the requests that contain attack payloads. Now, certainly, if you wanted to take a stronger posture and configure it to say, okay, I'm going to block all traffic, you could certainly do that. Obviously,
if it's only blocking, you know, payloads that are, you know, targeting you, what's the point of having the honeypot, right? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, if they then, those people are then throwing stuff at your honeypot, like, how does that help you when they start going after your primary application?
Yeah, and that's a good question. And it depends, right? Like, maybe you want to take a more aggressive posture against certain IPs, right? And have less tolerance for, you know, attacks or any kind of other traffic from them, right? And so that's one way. And you know, that it's a good question, right? Like, you what do you want to do with this? How do you want to handle it? It does it just become, this is one piece of information plus, you know, other things as well, right? So I think that's where, you know, especially at the app layer, you know, that kind of deception space needs to mature a bit and figuring out what the right model is. But it, at the same time, it's going to look different from organization to organization. The good news is, you know, if you have signal sciences, your team is freed up to think about those things.
To be around with this sort of thing. Yeah. See, I don't know, man. I don't personally feel like it's there yet. You know, like I get the, I think what Haroon did with Thinkst was really interesting. Cause like, if you want to call that deception, but you know, the idea of just having a really simple honeypot on the inside is what gives you the good signal. When you start talking about, you know, application honeypots on the outside, I don't know. I just don't know how far it gets you. I don't know what action you take when you've got that kind of signal on the outside, unless, you know, you've placed your flag, your like deception flag somewhere deep within, you know, the trusted side of an application, like someone is hitting something in a database that like they need a privileged position to be able to do, like that seems like a good signal. But just like putting flags up that anyone can hit just seems like, okay, well, what do I do with that information now I've got it? I just don't feel like we've worked that one out yet.
Yeah, totally. I think there's definitely more work to be done there. I mean, maybe those kind of obvious flags that are out there are just like lower hanging type fruit things. But to your point, right, like then you have additional flags that are deeper into the application, maybe even, you know, post authentication, right, that an authenticated user should never access this part of the application, right? So if that IP source has, you know, hit that low hanging fruit on the outside, plus now it's hit this internal flag as well, then that kind of adds up to a higher threat kind of rating, right?
Now, look, one of the things that you wanted to speak about on this podcast is you kind of want to take a big old dump on runtime application self-protection software, which is, you know, it's becoming kind of a hip thing, but you think it's too hard. Tell us a bit about that.
So RASP is interesting, and I actually have a, if you go to the labs.signalsciences.com, that's our blog site, I wrote basically a dear RASP letter in the form of a blog. And it is kind of talking about my thoughts on this and really it's highlighting, you know, how signal sciences differentiates from those solutions. And this truly goes back to my experience as a practitioner before joining signal sciences, because I as a buyer was approached by RASP companies. And you know, with these solutions, and after looking at them, I got to tell you, so RASP, it, just as the concept, right? Like intriguing, very intriguing, right? Like the approach that they're taking, you know, kind of the deep, data flow analysis. It's on the surface to an AppSec person, you're like, wow, this is awesome. This is kind of the true next thing to be doing to defend our applications. But the one thing I realized that just given how you have to deploy it, which is really an app by app process. And I worked in a large enterprise, right? So there was just, you know, hundreds and hundreds of apps that we would want to have coverage on. I honestly could just not fathom the effort. It's like, I'm not going to approach all these app teams and have to argue with them to convince them, hey, I need you to install this vendor's code that integrates with your app at the point where it's basically, you know, modifying your code at runtime to wrap around it, right? So, because that argument, right? Obviously, you have to battle the performance, the performance argument and concerns there. But then, even if I convinced an app team to get it installed into production, if they ever experienced a performance problem, whether it was the fault of the RASP tool or not, they're going to say, "Rip it out," right?
Yeah.
And I'll never be able to get it back in. And it wouldn't scale, right? Like if I had one application I had to deal with, then yeah, I could probably manage getting it deployed there and kind of controlling, you know, any kind of issues and things like that. But from a deployment effort, I just feel exhausted thinking about it. To go through all those app teams, it just wouldn't scale in that regard, right? So there's just a lot of friction in the deployment process, which you know, signal sciences actually, because of how it's architected and designed, it actually alleviates that problem, right? Like it's very frictionless to install. It's easy to install. And you know, the feedback is that we get from customers and even prospects is, you know, obviously AppSec people love it, but even the dev people love it as well because it's like, oh, that's all I have to do? Oh, I'm getting protection and visibility? Oh, wow, that was quick, you know, and they love it, right? So I think that's one key piece. The other piece of it was, these RASP tools were, pretty focused on, the big technologies that they need to have coverage on. So, Java and .NET, right? Like those are the two big ones. But in the organization I was in, the whole DevOps world was coming about. Lots of boutique new languages were coming out, and everybody wanted to do something in Node.js or, some other variant of a Java framework and things like that. I realized I would have had to make a trade-off decision, right? Like, okay, if I went with this RASP solution, I could probably get coverage on, 70 to 80% of the applications, maybe. But then I just have to forego the rest of the applications or try to come up with some other solution for them, which is not really appealing, right? And actually, kind of an interesting story from a customer is they had actually gone with one of the RASP solutions, and it supported only a specific set of languages. And then a year later, there was this new initiative to start using a different language migrating all their apps to that, which the RASP did not support. So they had to go back to the drawing board. And obviously,
the TLDR is too hard.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of friction there, and the scalability of it, and there's a lot of effort involved. And frankly, we've been in bake-offs, right? And we've gotten feedback where, the RASP solution, they in some cases they couldn't even get it deployed with the app because of, various integration issues and bugs and things like that. So when you kind of go down that path, you have those problems, then the app team is going to be very skeptical. Any solution in the space has to be just a very frictionless, seamless installation and deployment for everybody to buy into it.
All right. Well, Phil Maddox, it has been a pleasure to chat to you. It's all very interesting stuff. I think that's given some listeners in web-heavy environments some stuff to think about. Really appreciate your time, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you. This has been fun.
That was Philip Maddox of Signal Sciences there. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Signal Sciences for being really a key sponsor of the Risky Business podcast. When we first started working with Sig Sciences a few years back, they were a small company. And, I wouldn't describe them as a small company anymore. They've been growing and growing. And yeah, we really love to see that when we're working with startups that are making useful tech. So yeah, that's it from me this week. I'll be back next week with another weekly news and current affairs edition of Risky Business. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.